Mentioned that in the covenant, the bridge with Abraham, that there were really that there are really no requirements on Abraham's part, except I'll try to move closer to the microphone. I'm sorry about the elevator music. Believe me, I don't like it any more than you do. Besides that, in the case of the bridge with Abraham, there were really no behavioral requirements mentioned on the part of Abraham and his descendants and the members of his household, except to circumcise. But circumcision is the very sign of the covenant, of the Brit. So that doesn't count, in a sense, or at least it seems not to count. So just wanted your comment or thoughts on that.
Apologize, I was pressing the wrong button. A little bit of attention deficit disorder here, so please bear with me. I'll repeat what I just said. I answered the question eloquently. I'll try to be as eloquent this time when you can hear me. Can you hear me? Okay. I said that that was an excellent question or remark, and let me clarify what I meant. In Genesis chapter 17, there is a single specific type of ritual requirement to circumcise the males that are party to the covenant, whether these are physical descendants or become members of the covenant household in some other way. Now, even though that is the only formal ritual requirement thus far, there is a broader requirement for God's covenant making. And that is, of course, that God selected Abraham precisely because Abraham walked in an unblemished way before God and with God. And of course, this becomes a covenant requirement, as it did with Noah. Now, the fact is that God is, as we know, is quite well aware that human beings are eventually going to violate that unblemished walking with God. Even good people who will have to repent and then come back to the covenant living. So at this stage, we see Abraham conducting himself, and in future chapters in Genesis, we see Abraham doing righteous deeds, but we don't have a list, a legal list of commandments. It says in Genesis chapter 26, verse 5, when God appears to Isaac and he explains that God made a covenant with Abraham because Abraham safeguarded my charge and observed my statutes and my laws. But these are not written yet. And these are not made explicit the way they are on Mount Sinai. And so we don't have the same type of covenant list of commandments that we have on Sinai. There is obviously the understanding between Abraham and God that there is only one God, which I suppose we have to say is a commandment of the Abrahamic covenant. There is only one God, and that is a requirement for the Abrahamic covenant, which is quite evident from Genesis chapter 12 and chapter 15. So again, it's a covenant structure, but it is only a foretaste of the coming Sinai covenant. But in here a little bit in this conversation that's going on in script here. Now that you mentioned the rabbis, there is a rabbinic tradition that does state that Abraham observed all the laws that were given to Moses on Mount Sinai, and he did this sort of intuitively and somehow knew them all. Well, I think that there is there's something that's not quite correct there, but in another sense there's a sort of half-truth that does sort of make its way through that rabbinic tradition. And the half-truth part of it, I think, is this. And that is that as a righteous person, Abraham desired to do the will of God in all things. And so, therefore, his heart would motivate him to act righteously in various situations without a lot of written guidance. And so it was just up to Abraham to choose the right thing. So therefore, in that sense, we can say that Abraham fulfilled God's commandments. I'm not sure 100% perfectly in the situation with Sarah, that's a whole other discussion. You know, that is with Sarah in Egypt and so on and so forth, with the Pharaoh and so on. But on the other hand, he was an extraordinarily righteous individual, and so therefore I think had this kind of intuition.
Do I have sound? Okay. You know, when you look at Abraham, there was never a requirement to believe that there only existed one deity. In fact, that issue never really came up until later on in Israel's history, mainly after the return from the Babylonian exile. That's when you have all the language that there only exists one deity, no other, there is no other God. When you look at the Israelites when they came out of Egypt, it specifically says that the Almighty was going to exact judgment upon the gods of Egypt, etc. Now, I don't believe there were any other gods, but that's not necessarily how it's worded, you know, then. The obedience that Abraham had was that when the Almighty called him, he left the land of his forefathers, just like it says. I went over to the land. There were certain other things that was told to him to do and so forth. And then you had the covenant of the circumcision. The covenant of Sinai is not the same covenant that Abraham had. They were actually commingled at Sinai, but prior to that, you didn't have things like Pesach, Sukkot. You know, all this was part of the Sinaitic covenant. You didn't have a priesthood of the house of Levi, etc. So there's no way to say that the Torah that was given to Moshe was the same Torah that Abraham was keeping. You know, that's the point I was getting at. And it's not so much as a beliefs system, how he believed, but it was the fact that he trusted in the Almighty and he obeyed him. And that was the main point.
Yeah, you had some very good points there. Your point about Abraham, I would agree with entirely, okay? He's not observing the Sinai covenant. There are things that overlap, obviously, because there are things, I think, that are innately righteous in human conduct that do get formalized in the Sinai covenant, but which are there as a matter of human, proper human conduct, even in the time of Noah. So there's things that are proper and improper. And in the time of Abraham, things that are proper and improper, and Abraham is responding to that. I think that as far as when the belief in one God arose. I would disagree with your comment there that it wasn't really until the exilic or post-exilic period where this requirement to believe in a single deity took root. We see throughout even some of the oldest portions of the Hebrew Bible, even from the most historical critical point, and I have studied in the course of my scholarship and the documentary hypothesis and a number of other theories about the complex composition of the Hebrew Bible, especially the Torah. Without going into all of that, because that is a very, very complex and lengthy discussion that requires a lot of deep knowledge of the Hebrew biblical text. However, what I would say in general is this, from my studies, is that the requirement, getting onto the specific point of the requirement to believe in a single deity, we see from the time of Moses, at least, okay, that this is an unconditional requirement for those that are in the covenant. And I'm talking about going back to the historical Moses, not just to whatever a final editor might have done to put, you know, a few polishes here and there or whatever on a biblical text. I'm talking about the very essence of a covenant is that there is only one deity that is recognized, and that is Yahweh, Yud-Heh, Wal-Heh, okay? If we take that verse that you mentioned, and that God would execute judgment on all the gods of Egypt, okay, the language, in my opinion, is simply that it's acknowledging that Egyptians believe in lots of gods. In other words, this is part of the warp and woof of ancient Near Eastern culture. And so there are, you know, so these things are called gods. Now, definitely by the time we get to Isaiah, Isaiah says clearly, but these are no gods. Okay, so that's the 8th century BCE, 2 centuries before the exile. Okay, now, but I think that even from the outset, the very nature of the Sinaitic covenant is the exclusivity of God, who, and I forget, maybe someone can find it, or knows what where the verse is, I think it's either Numbers of Joshua, okay, where Yud-Heh Wal-Heh, the God of Israel, okay, is described as Adon Kol Ha'aretz, okay, the Lord of all the earth. Now, some scholars have argued that this is what is called in scholarship henotheism, meaning that there's one big God, he's the boss, and there are still other gods, but they don't count so much, and they have to listen to the major God. Okay. Now, but I think that this, you know, the biblical text that we have clearly advocates against this view. It clearly wants to say that these other gods really aren't gods, and that there really is only one existent God who is worthy of that name.
Turn my headset. Can you all hear me in this mic? Okay, good. Knowing what Abraham did, he not only willing, he circumcised himself, and he was ready to offer up his beloved son, the son that the promise was made to offer him up as a burnt offering. And a person like this, no matter what the other commandments the Almighty throws at him, either at Sinai or any other place, this if you were a king, if you were a priest, or whatever that may be, based upon what he accomplished already, the obedience, he would have done so, every single one of them. It's given there was no Sinaitic covenant at that time, but he would have obeyed every single one of them if it was applied to him. So from that point of view, the Almighty knew his heart and his attitude, and that's why the Almighty says he obeyed teachings, my Torah. I agree with him. Okay, I'm done.
Sorry, I had to switch my settings. Too low? Is it loud now? Okay. We've been talking about different mighty ones, or Elohim, and Adonim, as David brought up. And I don't know if my points got lost in the text. The text moves pretty fast. So, in any case, I think it's quite clear, right from Bereshit, Genesis, through the examples of Noah, and the earlier examples of Cain and Hevel, and so on and so forth, that the Almighty has only ever been one mighty one. And all other mighty ones are not in the text. They don't exist. So the text of the Tanakh follows the relationship of Adam, or created beings, with the living mighty one who reigns above. Sinai, or Sinai, although different things like that, is not much different from what came before it. So I think that to make a dichotomy and what came before it is somewhat wrong. It portrays that the Almighty was different before Sinai in his dealings with his people. And I really don't see that, because the Almighty required Avram to come out of Ur, which was clearly a land where they had different idols and different worship, things of that nature. And Abraham also followed a number of laws that are consistent with the oath that was given at Sinai. So I think that the Almighty is pretty consistent from Bereshit right through to the end of the Tanakh, with his message of calling people to repent of their wickedness, to embrace the only mighty one, and obedience, and that's all I'd like to say. I wish you all a wonderful day, and may you continue to study the Tanakh. May Yah favor you all, shine his face upon you, and be present with you, that you may have a relationship with him and instructions. And to reiterate also to Michal, you said that you had been around Hindus, and you find it hard to relate to a being that is described as male. The female anatomy is not much different than the male. We have a heart. We both have the same basic physical structure, excepting for a few anatomical differences. And so I don't see how it's hard to relate to the Most High. He says that he created Adam in his likeness and image. And you know, we simply have to accept the fact that the Tanakh does describe the Most High as male. The text clearly uses that terminology, so we simply have to accept what the Tanakh says. Either that, or we have to admit that we're not proclaiming the Tanakh correctly according to its original text. And as to his form, he's been described in different visions by the prophets as having eyes of fire and so on and so forth. He manifested himself in various ways throughout the Tanakh. He appeared to Abraham as one of three different people. And so I think it's wrong to Judaism said that the Almighty not have. I think that's contradictory to the Tanakh.
I don't know who was speaking, but thank you very much. I think that most of what you said I agree with. I think you had some very perceptive comments, and then I'd just like to make a few minor qualifications on one point. The major point that you made, I think, was tremendous, and that is that, you know, God is not the one that's changing. Our understanding of God is changing, and that this, the God of Abraham is the God of Sinai. It's the same God. Now, there are, of course, a lot more detailed commandments in the Sinai covenant, and I think that there is evidence from the very outset of the creation account that we went over today, and that is that if we compare, which I'm not going to go into detail with now, but if we compare the Genesis creation account with pagan accounts of creation or pagan accounts of their chief gods, you know, in terms of the ordering of chaos issue and how pagans perceived that the earth and humanity came about, we see a stark contrast. Even though the Hebrew Bible is Moses and the other authors of Scripture are writing in an ancient Near Eastern context with that kind of lingo in mind and that kind of background, the thought process in the Hebrew Bible, including in the creation account of Genesis 1, is really at odds with the polytheistic notion that is found in the ancient Near Eastern accounts. Not only is there one single deity and only one who ever appears in Israelite biblical thought, so there, by that very implication, there's only one God who exists at all. So it is not henotheism, meaning a top God over a lot of small gods, but one single unique God. And the second thing is that this unique Israelite God precedes creation and precedes all else that is. Whereas in the pagan world and in the ancient Near East, this idea does not even exist in the slightest. Matter simply seems to exist. Certain gods seem to exist in the multiple already, and they don't explain how or why. And the creator God in Mesopotamian literature, in fact, is himself a creation of already existing gods and so on and so forth. And the whole idea of a god in Israelite literature is completely different than the idea of a god in Mesopotamian and Canaanite literature and even Egyptian literature. The Israelite idea of a god is that there only is one by nature, and that god has brought all else that exists, whether visible or invisible, into being. So I think that this is an essential point. The second thing that I want to follow up on, and that is the issue of God and gender in the Hebrew Bible. Now, it is quite clear that the ancient Near Eastern world was a patriarchal society. And that's a whole other discussion as to how to apply the Torah in those respects to modern Western civilization. However, I'm going to sidestep that issue because that's can go on for days, that particular discussion. But what I do want to say from a linguistic point of view in the Hebrew Bible, and that is that although God has definitely distinct male imagery, occasionally God is given female imagery. So God is described as consoling his son, consoling his people as a mother consoles her son. Okay? So in that sense, it shows that gender really does not apply to God. From a grammatical, linguistic point of view, biblical Hebrew has what most people today think of when they study languages such as French or Spanish or Latin or Greek or Hebrew as male or female. But the genderizing of these particular parts of speech as male or female, as far as the Hebrew language is concerned, dates from about the 12th century CE, that is century 1-12, after the destruction of the temple. Okay? The idea that these represent genders, meaning male and female. Okay? And for example, the supposedly female gender ending is applied to fathers. So instead of father, which is av in the its plural is avot, not avim, which is supposedly the so-called masculine ending, and so on and so forth. So this is a complicated grammatical issue. So again, while most of the images of the God of Israel, the Holy One of Israel, are male-oriented in Scripture, there are a few female images of God, and when there's no neuter in biblical Hebrew, so the default is the so-called masculine gender. But it really doesn't have anything to do with maleness or femaleness. I believe it's in Numbers chapter 23, verse 19. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong on the verse number there. Okay, where God says that he is not a man that he should lie, nor the son of man that he should deceive. Okay? God is not like humanity. When God created humanity in his image and likeness, he created Adam, which does not mean man in the male sense, except when it's talking about Adam, the guy. But when it's talking about Adam generally as a class of persons, it is talking about humanity, not man. Ish is man, Adam is humanity, Isha is woman. Again, Adam is humanity. And so he created Adam. He created male and female Adam. So that's a whole nother issue. Enough for now.
Okay, testing 1, 2, 3. Sound? Okay. I was going to ask a question, but I think I'll just start by mentioning that I think I disagree with you, David. in the sense that we see that the male form of or when a word takes on a male form, we can't just I don't see how you could just disconnect it from the idea that it's a male form or a female form, since it is in line with what we would say if we are talking about an actual male. In other words, like for instance, if I'm going to say, I don't know, the dog, you know, a dog, which could be either a male or female, just speaking in general terms, you know, goes to the garden. So I would say, kelev holech lagan, right? But that's using the same verb form as if I were to say that I, as a male, go to the garden. Ani holech lagan. So, and also the other point I wanted to make along those lines is that we do see that things that are more naturally male do take on the male form, and things that are more naturally female take on the female form, like av and im, right? So av is a masculine is a masculine noun, and im, av meaning father, and im meaning mother, is a female noun, right? And that's reflected if I add a verb to it. So I would say, if I want to say a father goes to the park, so I say av holech lagan. And if I want to say a mother goes to the park, I say im holechet lagan. So it seems that there is some kind of gender going on, or we can even see words that have male and female forms, like kelev, to use again the example I gave. I could say kelev, which means a male dog, or kalba, which means a female dog. So I don't see how you're able really to completely disconnect the male-female form. And in other words, you seem to be abstracting it and saying that it's just grammatical forms, but it doesn't really have any implications of masculinity or femininity. And I'm not sure that I agree with that. I think a lot of the words that would be naturally masculine, more masculine things, tend to have male form, and those that are more feminine would tend to have female form. Of course, there are always exceptions, and the example you gave of av and avot, where the plural takes on the standard female plural ending. These are exceptions, and these are very rare exceptions, right? Like tzipur and tzipurim. That's a female verb. That's a female noun or feminine noun that takes on a standard male ending. But I would have to go whip out my basic Hebrew grammar books again. But I think there are some underlying rules for that, having to do with what letters, or maybe it's not. Maybe they're just exceptions. But if they are exceptions, then they're very minor exceptions. The other point I wanted to make, and this was my original point, was expanding upon your idea, or the idea that a number of people mentioned, about the difference between the covenant with Abraham and the covenant at Sinai. And yes, the details are different, but the way I understand personally the covenant at Sinai is that the main idea of the covenant at Sinai is that it is a covenant of righteousness. In other words, the basic core of the Torah, of the covenant at Sinai with Israel, is to do righteousness, not to murder, not to steal, not to commit adultery, etc., etc. The same kind of thing that Abraham would have, as you mentioned, David, would have intuitively understood. The difference here is that in the case of Abraham, we're dealing with one person who had direct communication with God, at least some of the time. And in the case of the nation, we have to set up a structure. We have to set up a structure. We have to set up a sacrificial system. We have to set up holidays to commemorate the founding of the nation, to commemorate the various ideas that are inherent to the nation. So Pesach, not Pesach, Chag HaMatzot represents a remembrance of the coming out of Egypt, or the Passover sacrifice. Pesach represents a remembrance of the coming out of Egypt, and Shavuot represents giving thanks to God for the wheat harvest in the land, etc., etc. So there's a lot more formal structure around it, but I see all this as basically being support structure. And the real core of the covenant at the Sinai is righteousness, is being a righteous person. Anyway, those are my comments, and I'll release the mic.
Thanks for your comments. I think mostly we're in agreement. I was not trying to suggest, and maybe in trying to make my point, maybe I overstated it, so I will accept your correction there regarding the structure of Hebrew, the Hebrew language. A couple of things, though, I want to point out there where I disagree with you, and one point where I do continue to disagree. The point where I would agree is that, yes, when we're talking about animals and human beings, when when the indication of male or female gender of an animal or of a human being is involved, then yes, the language does use what has those forms which have come to be called gender in language. However, and with my clear agreement on that, 100%, but again, I emphasize that that is, that principally works in a definitive type of way with human beings and animals. On the other hand, when we speak of humanity, for example, as a generality, as a group, a male form is used, Adam, which does not mean men in the sense of male human beings. It means all humans, male and female. It's inclusive. When we talk about animals in Hebrew, okay, whether those animals are male or female in gender, when we talk about them as a group, they are behemot. That is a feminine, so-called feminine form, but we are talking about male and female animals. Okay, tell the shepherd to bring the animals back to the pen. Whether they're male animals or female animals, bring the behemoth back. Okay, so what I'm suggesting is it's much more complex in Hebrew than simply identifying a male gender and a female gender. And along those lines, for example, I mentioned avot, av singular for father, and avot for fathers, okay, with the so-called feminine form of the ending for fathers. And for women, isha, the feminine singular form of woman, and to make that plural, is nashim, having a masculine ending, a so-called masculine ending. I do not think that these can be passed off exceptions to a general rule that somehow came in. Now, there's the possibility that some of these, especially avod, is a certain type of ending that came in from Akkadian. A case ending that came in from Akkadian and so on and so forth, and there are various theories about how and why it's avot rather than avim. But without getting into all that technical discussion, I simply wanted to point out that in the creation account in Genesis chapter 1 verses 26 and 27, that God says that he makes Adam, okay, humanity in his image and likeness, okay, male and female, he created them. So the them and the male and female still refers back to the Adam, that is the collective, which in this case the collective happens to exist in the so-called male gender, but being by calling it male gender from a linguistics point of view does not in any way mean that it is simply including male individuals. It's including male and female, even though it's in that grammatical form. That was my point. And yes, I agree, this is 100%, this is a great time to take a very much needed break. Anyone else want to take over the mic, feel free. Shabbat Shalom.
Wow, it took so long to get back around to me. I don't know if my comments are even going to be pertinent, but you know, when it comes to grammatical gender, which is what this is, you know, it's fairly simple. It doesn't talk about the actual anatomy of anything. Basically, all grammatical gender does is it governs the sentence that is in and how the verbs are going to be conjugated. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person or thing you're speaking of is necessarily a male or a female. And it's like this in most Semitic languages. And Arabic has the same thing. You know, you have Arabic names like Talha, which is feminine. It's a feminine name, but all the verbs. And the verbs will be conjugated in the feminine with that name, but it's talking about a male. And the same thing goes with night or day. The word Eretz in Hebrew is feminine. And so the verbs that go with the earth is feminine. But that's only grammatical, and it has to do with verb conjugation and adjectives and so forth. And it has nothing really to do with that the earth is actually a feminine that gives birth to anything, really. But anyhow, the point was that I was trying to make earlier was not that there were multiple deities from the beginning, and that the Almighty said was explaining that he was the leader of some cultic pantheon or anything like that. That was not even the point. The point was is that belief in just a single deity was not really an issue there. In the language of that there was only one deity, there is no other, period, later. And though the Israelites had to be obedient to only one deity, that didn't necessarily at that time say that there was no other. So otherwise, the commandment would be redundant, saying you shouldn't worship other gods, when he could have simply just said, look, there is no other god, so I don't have to worry about you worshiping. But that's not the imagery we have. And I had another comment, and I can't remember what it was. I guess that's all I'm going to say there.
Like Gyalko said, with all of us having comments and questions and this, that, and the other thing, it has taken, you know, quite a while to come around. And so I put my hand up, and for a long time I was last. And I was just going to make the suggestion that this study is on covenant and not on whether he's male or female or she is female or whatever, or grammar for Hebrew or anything like that. And so we've all voiced, you know, our opinions. And I guess I just don't want to get away from the study itself because it is so good on covenant. And I was just thinking in the back of my mind, good grief. You know, I'm getting thirsty and I've just been on the mic for, what, 30 seconds? And he talked for like 2 hours. So if we don't give him a chance to go grab a drink and, you know, do whatever, a sandwich maybe, you know, we're going to wear him out and he won't be able to finish the study on us. And that's just my opinion. I just wanted to voice it. Thanks.
Well, I somewhat agree with you, Tirtza. But David can go get his drink. And that doesn't interfere with any discussions here. Well, of course, we can agree to disagree, Michal. my point is simply that when we have discussions on the Tanakh, that we should have a clear definition of what is in the Tanakh and what is simply people's opinions. And so you've stated that you and a few other people in the group here refer to the Mighty One as She. My point is, you have no scriptural text as a basis to refer to the Almighty as She. Now, I think that my point earlier was kind of ignored, but my point is, according to historical dating of archaeology, Job, is the oldest writing that we have to date. Now, when the Almighty appeared to Job in chapter 38, how did he appear to him? Yahweh responded to Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that gives murky counsel with words without knowledge? Gird your loins like a warrior. I will ask you to inform me, where were you when I laid the land's foundation? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its dimensions, if you know? Or who stretched a line over it? Into what are its bases sunken, or who is its cornerstone? Who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang in unison, and all the beings of Shamaim, the loftiness above, shouted, he dimmed in the sea with bolted doors as it flowed from the womb, or emerged from the womb." He continues throughout this speech to refer to himself as he. So, now, Michal, your questions do not pay attention to the context of the words and texts that you refer to. So when laws are written in masculine, of course it applies to male and female, because the male is the head of the female. The male was created first. The female was taken from the male. So the male always takes precedent in Ivrit, in Hebrew scripture, with regards to creation and with regards to the creator. So the creator has female characteristics within himself. The word ruach, for example, describes that. But the creator, on a whole throughout the Tanakh, is addressed as male. So my point is, if you're going to obey the Tanakh and believe in the Tanakh, you can't simply believe that the Tanakh is a book based on culture. In other words, you can't say that because in ancient times, males took leadership of society, that we must accept the Tanakh as the words of the Most High. And if the words of the Most High refer to the Creator as male, then we have to address him as male, as Father, as the Most High, as He. Not as She or as Mother. David quoted a text earlier that referred to the Almighty as being like a mother. Didn't say that we should address him as Mama or Mother. And so, in any case, I guess I'll have to disagree with a lot of you in this room who seem to think that the Almighty has no gender. But he was described in visions as being male. For example, the prophet Yeshayahu, Isaiah, the prophet Yechezkel, Ezekiel. And in that sense, then, Michal, Karaism is just the same as Judaism, in that they believe what they want to believe, regardless of what the Tanakh says.
Well, you know, I don't believe that that the issue is really that big of an issue. is grammatical gender. I know that it's going to take a lot for people to wrap their mind around that, but it's not talking about anatomy. Man and breath doesn't have a gender, although it's always in the feminine in the Hebrew. When you have languages like Greek, which actually has a neuter gender, when you see this, I'm not dumbing down with the knock, I'm trying to educate people. The ancient Hebrews, or any Hebrew would know that the son is not a woman. No more than you can go up and tell an Arab today, hey, you know, the son is spoken of in Arabic as in the feminine verb form. But that has nothing to do with anatomy. You're not going to go to the surface of the sun and find a womb anywhere. You're not going to find this long hair or mammary glands. That's not there. It's grammatical. And all that does is describe how the conjugation of the rest of the sentence is going to be. In Semitic languages, there wasn't a neuter gender, at least not in Arabic, Hebrew, or Aramaic. There were some Semitic languages that actually had a neuter gender. But I want to make a comment, though, about the word Selim. You know, whenever we look at Genesis, and it says, in verse 26 of chapter 1, that Elohim, and I said Adam, it's a man, continue. And Elohim says, let us make Adam, but so many in our selim, kidmatenu, after our demut, which is a likeness. And you see this used for Adam in the case of Seth. The word selim is used as a representative. It just means a representation. It's not necessarily an idol. Which is, you have other words for those, but when in the book of Numbers it says that, talking about the prophets, it says that the Almighty, if there was a prophet to rise up amongst Israel, then he would make himself known to him in a vision or a dream or so forth. But it says, not so my servant Moshe, who was faithful in all my house. With him he would speak, you know, mouth to mouth. And it says his selim he would behold, mer'eh, which means the selim of God would be apparent to him. The selim here is not that the Almighty had some form. There was this representative that spoke in his behalf. The same way is speaking here. It's not that we are created in the actual physical mold of God, but we are created as his representative on this earth to rule over all the earth. That was our original job. We were to guard it and work it and protect it and so forth. And when we failed, then the cherubim, after we were kicked out of the garden, the cherubim took over as the protectors of this garden. But anyway, you have a representative throughout the entire Tanakh, which spoke on behalf of the Almighty, and the names of God even applied, and a lot of these attributes applied to this selim, this representative, which is what we call the angel of the Almighty. Whenever you look at the story of Moshe in the burning bush, which is where the Sinai gets its name, it says in Exodus chapter 3, let me turn to it real quick, it says, and in chapter 3, it says, Vayirei Melech Yehoyada Ben-Hadesh. And the angel of the Almighty appears to him in the flame of fire, in the midst of the bush. where you are, and he looked, or he beheld, or he made. Here hath he made the bushes burn out with burning, the ash with fire, where hath he made, and the bush in many ochal, it was not being consumed. Okay, so when Moshe turned aside, the next verse, it says, where you are, Yehovah, he said a little oath, where you could. And so the Almighty looked and saw that he turned aside, and he says to him, and it says, the Elohim spoke to him, Metoch Hasanei. Now, this is an angel, it says, that appeared to him in this burning bush. But yet, Abel assumes that it was the Almighty who was actually in the burning bush speaking. And in the same manner, you had these angels, these three angels who appeared to Abraham, and it says that it was the Almighty who appeared to Abraham. But it's not that it was the Almighty as a physical being, but it was his son, it was his representative, something that represented him. Whenever we look in Exodus, it says that whenever we look at Exodus, and it talks about the Israelites, you know, says, you all spoke with the Almighty mouth to mouth, or face to face, however you want to look at it. The same that it talked with Moses. I think it's in Deuteronomy chapter 5. But it says that everyone in Israel spoke to him face to face, and that they didn't see a form, but they heard the voice. Now, in my opinion, it's this Melech Yehoveh, the angel or the messenger of the Almighty, which is what Melech means, messenger. Angelus is the Greek, which means messenger of the Almighty, is what is known, what we see as the Selim of the Almighty, who comes to us in a certain form that we can comprehend. And this doesn't happen to everyone. The only difference was, is that with Moshe, it says he spoke to him mouth to mouth, you know, and however you want to take that, I'll leave that up to you. But I don't believe that the Almighty has a physical form, and when you use the anthropomorphic signs in the scripture to designate the Almighty as such, then I don't believe that it's talking about this literally the Almighty himself. But maybe in the movie. That's my opinion of it.
Yaakov, excuse me, Bill. Yaakov, you dropped the mic on your last sentence, and we heard the first part, not the middle, and the last half, the last part of your last sentence. Can you repeat just that last sentence?
Yeah, I was just saying that when you see anthropomorphic signs in the thing, well, the Almighty has a hand, or he's got wings, or whatever, and he's got feet, that these are representatives. This is the Selim that is for our benefit, so that we can have some sort of an understanding, and not that it was actually the Almighty himself who says he has no form. That's how I'm getting it.
Okay, I gotta make a statement regarding the comments that were made about Karaites. Karaites are not, Karaites do not say we agree to disagree. No, not always. There are certain basic principles that we go by. Okay? And no Karaite would accept a practicing homosexual as a Karaite, a fellow Karaite in the community. No Karaite would accept an idolater as a Karaite. And there are so many other basic principles. So just to say generically Karaites agree to disagree, that's what Karaism, that's nonsense. Okay? And also, Shaul, we are not like the rabbinites. Just don't go by so whatever we feel like. Well, Nikhil, that's not my forum, my form of Karaites. Every Karaite community has certain regulations, certain standards. Okay? Well, that's okay, Mela. I can sit with a lot of the time, so what? Any organization, any group has certain standards. And once you violate those standards, you cannot be part of the group. Karaites are no different from that. You just can't have somebody come up and say, well, I'm going, no Karaite that I know of has written anything saying, okay, you can call the Almighty a she or a it. He doesn't say that. It's not a Karaism to say you can call the Almighty a she. Okay? Now, some Karaites, like Nikhil, who calls herself a Karaite, may want to do so. Okay? And maybe nobody would say anything about it, because she's not part of any group right now anyway, as a Karaite. But if I am part of a Karaite group, either an Egyptian Karaite or a worldwide World Karaite movement or whatever the others may be, we all have standards. We are not without standards. There are standards, there are certain areas, they are debatable, that we can come to different interpretations, textually. Those things are left alone. Not everything is left alone for everybody to come up to their own conclusion. I do not set the standards, but the group that you or I belong to sets the standards. Evidently, you are not a member of any Karaite community, are you, Malak? If so, if you are, there are standards for the Karaite community. Don't tell me you don't have any standards. Every community has a standard. But you can start your own and call it another Karaite community. You have no standard. That's fine. I know of no group calling themselves Karaites without any standards or statements of faith. Okay, enough of that ranting. Come on, Phil.
Anybody hear me? Anybody hear me? Okay, yeah, I guess everybody knows that Brit Shalom is finished for today, and that and because our questions took too long, so we're going to come back next Shabbat, and we hope that everybody will be here at 12 p.m. Central Standard Time, sharp, so that he doesn't come and has to wait around for everybody to show up. He actually waited an hour before he could start because no one was here. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say. We recorded the teaching and a lot of the question and answer, which we'll probably split into two parts because it was well over 2 hours. Free mic.
Okay, testing 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2, 3. Okay, just very quickly on Bill's point, which I did not really, that wasn't my intention in raising my hand at all. I really want to focus on other points, but every group obviously sets their standards, but I think that that one of the standards for this particular group is that there's freedom of thought, and you seem to present a much more strict view of what is acceptable and not acceptable. And I know that many people left "quote unquote" organized charism because of certain opinions that were forced on them. Right? I won't go into specifics, but that's the case. And I think as long as anyone is doing a true and honest search for the truth of the Torah, right? The name of the room here is Torah Truth Seekers. We're seeking the truth in the Torah, and as long as anyone is engaged in that, then I think that that is the purpose of this particular group. And if you're looking for a more strict form of charism, then perhaps it's you who should seek out a different group. Okay. At any rate, that's not why I raised my hand. What I wanted to speak about was this whole idea of gender again. And I actually I forgot what I was going to say, so just give me 1 second here to try to remember it. I guess the main point I wanted to make is I'm still disagreeing with this idea that we can completely disconnect words. Oh, I do remember the other thing I wanted to say. Oh, that in a second. Actually, let me get to that first. I did want to agree with Shaul Ben Yehuchanan on the idea that God is masculine. Of course, that means I disagree with Michal, but I will not throw her out of the group or stomp on her face with cowboy boots, even though I disagree with her. So what I wanted to bring was a couple of verses in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Okay, we have in, just find it here, we have Genesis 1:27, where it says, Vayivra Elohim et Adam b'tzalmo, v'tzalmo Elohim bara oto, zachar v'nikeva bara otam. Okay, so to translate, it says, and God, and Elohim created man in his image, in the image of man, he created them, male and female, he created them. So one could say, well, this means that when man was created, it means that male and female were created in a sense on equal footing, or that they were both created at the same time. Okay. However, we know when we go into the detail of the story in chapter 2, we know that's not true. And therefore I see this verse which David brought before as kind of just a summary verse. Okay, it's just saying giving a summary of the creation of mankind without giving the details, and that's why it says that zachar unikeva bara otam, that male and female he created them. Because it's an overall summary verse. But if we go to Bereishit chapter 2, if we go to Genesis chapter 2, let me just go there. Oops, wrong direction. If we go to Genesis chapter 2, we see that the story, I won't, you know, I don't have to bring the verses because you all know the story, but let me just bring one or two verses here. Let me just find it. So first, God brings all the other creatures which he has created to Adam, so that Adam can find a ezer knegedo, a helper with him or against him, or however you want to translate that. And it says in Genesis 2, chapter 2, verse 19, Wayetzer Yehovah Elohim min ha'adam. We tzer Yehovah Elohim min ha'adama kol hayat ha'sadeh et kol of ha'shamayim, and he created, and Yehovah Elohim created from out of the earth all of the beasts of the field and all of the flying, kol of ha'shamayim, all of those things that fly in the air, and then it says Vayave el ha'adam li'ot ma yikra lo. Wrong verse. Give me 1 second here. It's verse 20. Okay, so verse 20 says, "Vayikra Adam Shemot l'chol ha'behema," and the man, meaning at this point Adam, gave names to all of the animals, ula of ha'shamayim, and the things that fly in the sky, ula chol hayat ha'sadeh, and for all the wild beasts of the field, ula adam lo matza ezer knegdo, and the man did not find a suitable helper for him. Right, so then we go on to see that he's put to sleep, and a rib is taken out of his body, and out of that a woman is created. So whether one believes this, whether one believes this literally or as a metaphor, or it doesn't really matter. The point is that the Tanakh, that the Torah does say that man was created first. Man was the forethought. Man was the first thought. The masculine creation was the first thought, and seems to be the true representation or physical manifestation or physical representation of Yehovah, of God. Whereas the woman was created not in the image of God, in a sense. She was created in the image of man, right? She was taken as a rib out of man, and then created in his image. So the woman seems to be an afterthought, whereas the man seems to be a forethought and created directly in the image of God. In other words, when God first created Adam, when he created the first man in his image and his likeness, it was a male and not a female, and the female was created in a sense in the likeness of the man. So I agree 100% with Shaul ben Yohanan that the man is the forethought and therefore the most closely resembles God. Now, that does not mean to say, Michal, that in any way, shape, or form that a woman is. I don't even have to say it because you already know. You already know. But it doesn't mean that a woman is lower in any way or not a human being or anything along those lines. Even though I think it's obvious, I'll just say it anyway. Okay, and the other point I wanted to make, maybe I'll just let someone else speak and then I'll raise my hand afterwards.
Okay, sorry about the pause. I went to click on the mic, and instead I moved my my box narrower. Okay, my question is a question for David. So if you're around, if you could make note of this. When you were talking back in the beginning of creation, about the light on the first day and then the light on the fourth day, that the light that was created on the fourth day was for the specific purpose to separate the day from the night or the light from the darkness. It's an off topic. It doesn't do, I don't think, with covenant. It might have, but I don't think it does. But I would like to hear what your thoughts are on that. Was the light on the first day the sun, and then the light that was created on the fourth day to separate that light from the darkness, but to also indicate the Moedim, the set appointed times and stuff, was that fourth day light that was created the stars and the moon, or was it saying that the sun was not created until the fourth day? I hope I made my question clear.
In fact, I agree with Shaul and Malak when it comes to the gender issue in regards to the Almighty. I have no problem with that. But I disagree with Malak. This group, Torah of Truth Seekers, is not a Karaite community and not a Karaite group that I know of. If it is, it's something new to me. Okay? This is a group of Torah of Truth Seekers. I am one of them. That's why I'm here. I may not agree with everything, but this is a good forum to belong to discuss things. Because based upon what I know, Michal, what Martha told me, but she can correct me, she can come and say, this is the Karaite community, this is a Karaite group, then I'll shut up. Until then, this is not a Karaite community, this is not a Karaite group, this is a Truth Seekers group. Last time I talked to her, they were going to be called a Karaite. So, when there are a lot of ex-Karaites in this group, that's fine. There are also some Christians, there are some Messianics, and there are some Jews who are struggling. So what? But this is not a Karaite community. Until Martha tells me, or Phil tells me, it is, then I would say, okay, I'm wrong. But it never was meant to be a Karaite community. It's not a Karaite group. With that, I'll shut up. Shall we come in?
Well, I guess I have to take the blame for starting it, because I got Bill started on it. But my statement was kind of taken. Hold on, let me read Chirtz's comment here. Okay. Yeah, we can discuss some more in private, Tirtza, by email, of course. I think I still have your email. I'll have to look it up. But you know, for those of you who are asking in the room if I would teach, or if Yaakov would, Yaakov's gone, so he can't answer that. But as for my part, I'll be talking with Tirtza, and I'll probably propose a few subjects, and then you folks can decide if you like the subject topic, and we'll begin, or whatever. So, you know, my point is not to convince any of you of the things that I believe. I know what I believe according to the Tanakh, so I'll share that, and you guys can take it for what it's worth. I know that most people probably won't believe me anyway, because you know, beliefs are a hard thing to give up. A case in point is my recent discovery of the definition of Yisrael according to the Tanakh. Okay, I know that many Karaites are people who used to... I do not define myself as a Karaite, but I do believe in going by Mikra, the word that is called out by the Most High, and not alone, so I guess you can say I am in that sense. And I also left the New Testament myself. And having done that, I brought over the belief, and I believe that this is rooted in Christianity, and the belief is that if you believe in the Almighty, and you believe in his words, and you obey those words and follow him, then you are Yisrael. You take on that identity as Yisrael. But clearly, according to Scripture, the 12 tribes are distinct people. They are a bloodline. It would be like my son. Someone coming along and saying, I'm Gedaliah. Well, no, you're not. My son is Gedaliah. You are not. You know, you can be like my son. You can be like Gedaliah. You can follow the Most High and worship according to the Tanakh, but you are not my son Gedaliah. So that's my point. I can teach on that on another subject, or on calendar issues, which is my main passion, or other issues, but you know, I'm happy to be amongst a group of you that believe in the Tanakh and believe in the Creator, and, you know, so regardless of what we've talked about, I think Malek hit the nail on the head when he quoted from Bereishit chapter 2, that the male was created first, and that ultimately was in the form and likeness of the Most High. So that was my reason for saying that, you know, when I envision the Most High, I envision him as seated on the throne, and I worship him. And, you know, I have a great passion for the Most High and his Tanakh, and I think all of you do here as well. And that's the main point of getting together to discuss and to chat and to grow in the knowledge of the Tanakh. But I think that there's been something that's been overlooked here in our discussion. You know, Yaakov was talking about grammar. How, for example, if the word yod, hand, is mentioned in Scripture, then you can't really take it literally. It's simply a grammatical phrase. But I think it's very important that people understand that the Tanakh is not simply a book written by a people of a particular culture and a particular grammar. Either you accept the Tanakh as being supernatural and the words and thoughts of the Most High, or you make it the sophistry of a people, of a particular culture, and a particular grammar. I don't think that's what the Tanakh is a product of. I think it would give you all a firmer grasp of the Tanakh and a better understanding of it if you'd simply take it as face value from the Most High and not, you know, I mean, the Christian teaching is that the Old Testament, as they call it, is stories and ancient culture. I think we have to get rid of that perspective, not culture, it's the Tanakh, and it's a product of the Most High.
Okay, on to more serious topics here, rather than the chatter that's taking place on the side. I wanted to get back again to this idea of masculine and feminine in Hebrew, and I don't think that. Again, David, and he's not here to respond, so maybe another time he can respond. But I don't think it's plausible to disconnect the masculine and feminine gender of certain nouns from the underlying idea of a masculine meaning and a feminine meaning. Let's just put it this way. I mean, we could have the language could have been broken down in other ways. In other words, let's say everyone under the age of 25 may have used one verb form, you know, which instead of the male verb form, we'll call that the young verb form, and everyone over the age of 25 could have used another verb form, right? You have this in certain languages, like in Spanish, where we have tu and usted. I think in a bunch of the Romance languages, right? But in Hebrew, it wasn't broken down that way. It was broken down as masculine form and feminine form. So that way, if I'm a male and I say I go, I say ani holech, and if I were a female and I say I go, I say ani holechet, right? So that's the underlying separation here. So to then go ahead and say that the words of Hebrew are somehow disconnected from this underlying distinction, which could have been broken down in many ways. It said young versus old, who knows, black versus white, Israelite versus non-Israelite, could have had different verb forms. There were a million ways to break it down, but it was broken down as male and females, masculine and feminine, and this surely would have been something that the ancient Israelites, as they brought new words into the language, or as the language developed, however it developed, even if it was God's language, you know, the original language of God, which is certainly a valid claim, then I think that would have been something that they would have been aware of. Also, I see that all I could do is think of anecdotal evidence offhand, but if I take a number of words, let's say, that would be most closely associated with feminine things, which are not necessarily female things, but feminine, and part of this is modern Hebrew, so maybe it doesn't apply to biblical Hebrew, but let's say a dress, right? A dress is a simla, right? Is a buba, that's really modern Hebrew. You know, things that would most naturally be feminine. I don't know if anyone could think of any other examples. And I certainly haven't done an exhaustive study, but it seems to me that they tend to have usually feminine endings, and obviously take on the feminine adjective and verb forms, and whereas more masculine things, like, I don't know, soldier. Well, soldier's a human being, so maybe that doesn't count, but let's say, I don't know. Well, war. War is milchama, so maybe that doesn't count. So I don't know. I'd have to think about it more. But certainly the basic underlying distinction in biblical as well as later Hebrew, is masculine and feminine for the verb forms. So I just don't think that can then be completely abstracted, or one could say that those forms are just completely abstracted when not applied to actual males or females. Okay, that's my thoughts, and I'll release the mic.
Anybody hear me? Am I coming through on the mic? Okay, anyway, I just wanted to, since we were discussing other speakers and other teachers, then, and of course, everyone who knows me knows I've said this before, that the premise of this room, of Texi's room, Texicans or Us room, is that to knock only, and I kind of like to think it would be ideal if we could sort of forget all of our previous experiences in pursuing the Almighty, and sort of start out with a blank slate and fill that slate with what we find in the Tanakh. And then that means that if you want to say something and you can justify it with book, chapter, and verse, then you're on solid ground. If you come in here and you want to pull stuff out of the air and you can't back it up with scripture, then you're just wasting your time and you're wasting our time. So for potential teachers who, of course, understand that Brit Shalom is we're not going to have other teachers until Brit Shalom does not teach. Anybody can teach here as long as they can back up what they say with book, chapter, and verse. Speculation is a waste of your time and a waste of our time. There's a time and a place for that, but I hope that any teachings are based upon solid scriptural evidence. Okay, free mic. Your mic, Shaul.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Mel Girly Man. The whole point is to have references for what you believe. And I think that was the problem with earlier, was that I was sharing some texts. I know Melech was, I know Yaakov was. But there are certainly a lot of people in the room that were simply sharing their opinion, you know. And if you claim to be based on the Tanakh, then you certainly have to have something in the original text of it to back up that claim. You can't simply say, you know, I believe this, but don't have anything to back it up with.
I just wanted to say one other thing, too, about, you know, I guess we all know that there are many points of disagreement. There are points that the Tanakh is not especially clear about, unfortunately. And so we know right now we don't have a proof. We do, but it's not apparent at this moment. And so in order to, if we have uniformity, then unity is probably not going to be a reality. We will splinter. So we have to accept that there are certain areas of the Tanakh that are not especially clear, and to insist that we have a precise answer to every conceivable question, I think, is a fantasy. There are things that we are not going to know without a priest and without a prophet. Now, it's really great when we have people who are very knowledgeable of Hebrew and the Tanakh and have been exposed to extensive teachings and research like Brit Shalom. And so we're all looking forward to hearing what he has to say. But I think if we insist upon uniformity, we are doomed to disunity. Free mic.
Well, I think that you have a point there that there are things that people are going to opinions on particular definitions of words and things like that. But the more that you have division and one, it doesn't bode well for a message that you're presenting to the world. So I think at some point, people who believe in the Tanakh are going to have to come together and say, either this is in the Tanakh or it's not. And not being pleasant and nice about the fact that people disagree about things that are so obviously not in accordance with the original text.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello everyone in the room. I like to join your chat time to time. I like to speak also. Thank you very much. If you do accept me, I will stay with you. If not, I will go out of your room. Thank you very much for giving me a chance to speak. Thank you, that's all I was going to say. You can take back the mic. Thank you very much.